Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, July 29th. Today we hear from the University of Hawaii Medical School Dean as we start the new academic year. We take a closer look at the military leases on Kauai following last week's public meetings. We learn more about how credits for affordable housing work in advance of a meeting to change the formula. And with canoes or va on the silver screen, we have rope on the brain. We hanaho an interview with a fiber artist on the traditional Hawaiian practice of cordage or kaula. And getting creative to spur innovation and entrepreneurship. We hear about a new initiative at Hawaii Pacific University. Tuned The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The fall semester is about to begin for students across the University of Hawaii system at the John A. Burns School of Medicine. The opening of a new home in Maui this past weekend will help with our goal to boost health care on the neighbor islands. Medical School Dean Sam Shoemaker joined us in studio this morning to explain what we mean by that. UH also just received the good news that it passed accreditation with flying colors, said to be the best report in the med school's 60-year history. We're starting out this new year, and you've got some bright spots on the horizon. This weekend, you just opened a new home on Maui. So tell our listeners about that.
Yes, we leased a four-bedroom home on Maui. It's about a mile from Maui Memorial Medical Center. And so this will expand our possibilities on the island of Maui. One of our main goals is to do more training in neighbor island settings, because that's where the physician shortage is the most acute. And our rationale is if we train and expose our medical students to what it's like to practice in a neighbor island community, then they may well decide to set up shop when they graduate from medical school. So in the particular case on Maui, this new house will allow us to have more student rotations on Maui. Previously, students who were going to Maui for rotations would have to live with their parents or with a relative. So this gives us much more freedom to offer rotations on Maui to people that don't have family ties there. And so I think it will be a real shot in the arm for the Maui medical community, because we're hoping that at least some number of these students would eventually want to set up practice on Maui.
Yeah, and housing is still a challenge there because of the wildfires.
Right.
And so the fact that you now have a place to call home for those students, I think it is really important.
Yes, it is. And we face similar challenges on the other neighbor islands as well. Kauai is particularly problematic, and we're trying to really grow our footprint on Kauai. We have the Kauai Medical Training Track, where we educate a cohort of six students in every class, and they spend about a third of their curriculum on the island of Kauai. But it's perennially a problem finding them accommodations and living arrangements.
And I know that across the state, there's been this concerted effort to raise the bar when it comes to health care on the neighbor islands, and particularly the rural areas. And we've seen the hospitals step up, and then the med school, obviously. But yet you don't think about the housing part. That often gets overlooked.
Yeah, the logistics are very important. Not only do the students need a place to live, but they also need transportation. So we ship their cars to whatever island they're doing their rotation on so they can get around. So we make every effort to make it feasible for the students to have a good experience when they are rotating on a neighbor island.
with the hope that, that they will want to land in those rural hospitals.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's a bright spot. And then I understand that the university med school has just earned the accreditation for the next 8 years.
Yes, yes. Very glad tidings, so to speak. Accreditation is a major institutional commitment. It requires literally thousands of person hours to prepare for. And we started 2 years in advance. And we were gratified to learn that we only had 3 citations, which is very unusual. Most schools have upwards of 10 to 15 citations. So 3 minor citations. They gave us a full 8-year term of accreditation. It was a massive effort, but well worth it, because without accreditation, we can't grant students the MD degree, and we'd basically be out of business.
And so this was what, probably the med school's best showing?
It was, yeah. It was our most successful accreditation in the school's 60-year history. And it's important because that is a testament to the quality of the education that we provide to our students. Our students are very happy with the educational experience they have at JABSM, ranging all the way from the curriculum to how we deal with student affairs type issues. And so the students are our best advertisement for the quality of the school. And I think that came through when they met with the accreditation site visit team.
Okay, so kudos to the faculty and staff for pulling together and shining on the test, right?
Yeah.
And then the 3 areas where you folks need, that you need to work on, what are those areas?
2 of the areas were kind of technical issues about committees, the admissions committee and the curriculum committee. And both of those committees have to be composed of a majority of faculty members by virtue of the accreditation standards. And that was, in fact, the case in our situation, but the way they looked at it, they felt that we fell short and that there was not a majority of faculty members on these committees. So we just have to tweak the mix and the terminology. And so those will both be easy fixes. The other one related to how we review our curriculum. And again, we were doing it, but we just didn't have enough evidence in the minutes of the curriculum committee that would allow them to ascertain that we met the standard.
And this isn't your first rodeo when it comes to accreditation, but was there anything that you feel deserves a shout out where there was a turnaround, let's say, over the last time when we went through accreditation, where there was marked improvement?
Well, I think it was a pretty solid performance all the way across the board. So I think everybody who met with the survey visit team brought their A game and conveyed a very positive impression of things that were happening on the ground at the school. So they met with a whole range of different people during the site visit, including students, residents and fellows, faculty members, leadership, hospital partners. Our hospital partners really showed up and backed our efforts and said that we have a very vibrant and strong partnership with our health system.
We're all in lockstep.
Yeah, everybody was in lockstep, and that shone through.
And I have to ask, though, because this year has been a tough one for federal funding, and we have talked to President Wendy Hensel and Basilio Sirmos about those very things, the cuts, and how we're having to deal with it. And we watched that number jump from 30 to, I believe it was 78 million. And so scary numbers.
Yeah.
But what can you tell us about the situation at the medical school and the funding that was supposed to be cut?
Yeah, so we did have fairly significant cuts that started happening around 3 months ago. And we lost around $5 million in grant funding. Actually had to reduce people's FTE and in some cases even lay some people off.
FTE is full-time status?
Full-time equivalents. Mm-hmm. But by virtue of some litigation that was engaged in by the Attorney General and the Association of American Medical Colleges, those terminations were enjoined by the federal courts, and the government was obliged to reinstate the funding. So those dollars have started flowing back to the school, but this may be merely a temporary reprieve. We're not sure what lies ahead, because a lot of what happens will be determined by the president's federal budget for the next fiscal year.
So we could still fall off the fiscal cliff.
Yes,
potentially.
Could.
But the good news is that some of those programs, and I think one of them is a minority health research training program. And we had Dr. Vivek Nurkar on the show before talking about the good work that does to elevate students from across the Pacific.
Yeah, we're particularly gratified to see that particular grant reinstated, because it does serve an important purpose, training Pacific Islanders in research techniques with the hope that it will inspire them to pursue careers in healthcare or biomedical research.
Yeah, and we have featured a couple of your alum. You have trained a couple of Marshallese doctors.
Right.
One of them is in Arkansas, and he was a bright light for that community, the Marshallese community in Arkansas during COVID.
Yeah.
And that was an important time for the community to hear from one of their own. And so what other programs have been jump-started?
A couple of individual grants were restored, and another training grant that focuses on providing research skills to junior faculty members. Those were some examples of some grants that have been reinstated. What we don't know is what's going to happen legally, because the administration has appealed this ruling of the federal district court to the Supreme Court. And so we may know within the next week or 10 days whether those grants will survive or will be re-terminated, if you will. We're kind of waiting on pins and needles for whatever happens at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's crazy, because you're about to start the academic year.
Yeah. We deal with what we have to deal with, and if that's something we have to deal with, we'll deal with it.
And then are there any faculty or staff that you know of that are affected by the visas and the clampdown on that
area? Not at JABSM, but I think there have been some examples at the university writ large that might have had some negative impacts.
Okay, but there was nobody, let's say you were hoping to hire, that maybe got tangled up in that?
No.
Okay, all right. Anything else you want to say just about the start of this new school year and the outlook for 2025-26?
Despite the uncertainty at the federal level, I'll come back to our accreditation success, because it's a testament to how good a medical school we have here in the state of Hawaii. And we're training excellent physicians for this community. And as the state's only medical school, we have a kuleana to do that. And I think the community can take some comfort in the fact that the accreditors thought that we are doing a fantastic job of training physicians for this community. So it's a very positive story.
Okay. All right. Dean Shoemaker, thank you so much for sharing the story of the med school at this point in time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Catherine.
That was UH Medical School Dean Sam Shoemaker, who dropped by this morning to talk about the school's reaccreditation, the ongoing uncertainty of federal funding cuts, and creating more housing for medical students on the neighbor islands.
I'm Russell Subiono. Join me and Mehana Makainai for HPR's new podcast, Feathers and Fire. We'll take a closer look at every episode of the new Apple TV Plus series, Chief of War. Plus, special guests will share their behind-the-scenes stories. Listen to the pre-show episode on July 31st, and then regular episodes release on Saturdays starting August 2nd, wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Par Hawaii, committed to producing renewable fuels for Hawaii's airlines, electric utilities, and other industries. Learn more at parhawaii.com.
The military has hit some recent roadblocks in its efforts to renew land leases on Oahu and Hawaii Island. The State Land Board last month rejected the U.S. Army's environmental impact statement on its Pahakaloa training facility on the Big Island. Today's lead story from Honolulu Civil Beat concerns the U.S. Navy's land leases on Kauai. Civil Beat reporter Blaze Lovell joins us live. Good morning, Blaze. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Catherine.
Yeah, so, you know, we know that they held a number of public meetings, 2 weeks ago now, about the Barking Sands leases?
Yeah, so the Navy, you know, sort of wants to avoid a situation where they're going before the land board, you know, in a few months or in a year, and then they're facing the exact same situation with that the Army saw, which was getting, you know, these really preliminary reports sort of rejected, but those preliminary reports are important because they're, you know, the things that they need to get accepted before they can enter these leases, which the military says is, you know, necessary for the national defense. So a few weeks ago, Navy officials opened, you know, some public hearings on their own environmental impact statement for lands that they lease near the Pacific Missile Range facility on the southwest shore of Kauai. You know, they heard from neighbors and residents. There's a lot of talk about, you know, wanting to keep public access to the Barking Sands Beach for Kauai residents, as well as open fishing areas in the waters over there for people to use for cultural practices or for recreation.
Yeah, and, you know, it is a concern because those leases are coming up close to, like, what, 2030, right?
Between 2027 and 2030, so actually, like, really quite soon, actually.
And so, yeah, their strategy, but a little bit different than the Army's?
Right, and they're taking a bit of a different tack, and they seem to want to be getting out ahead of, you know, some of the things that critics and even the State Department of Land and Natural Resources sort of ding the Army for. So one of them is outreach to Native Hawaiian communities. Last week, the officials with the Navy and the folks who put together this environmental report, they're giving a presentation to the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. You know, they said that in preparing this draft report and going forward in completing the final environmental assessment, they're engaging with Native Hawaiian groups, including residents on Kauai, and that includes this group called the Aha Moku Council. Now, the Aha Moku Council is created within the state. They're part of the Department of Land and Natural Resources. They're sort of like a Native Hawaiian advisory group, and they have representatives of each island. I spoke to the executive director of that group yesterday, Limana Damare. She said that, you know, the Army didn't reach out to them before they published their two reports that ended up getting rejected earlier this year. They had only gotten to talk with them after the fact, you know, after they had already come out opposing those reports. Instead, you know, she said that they were able to talk to the Navy before this most recent draft came out, and they've been, their representative on Kauai has been meeting with them regularly. He says he has a pretty good relationship with the Navy, and he wants to maintain that going forward.
Yeah, you know, I know that folks always talk about negotiating in good faith, but, you know, you know, and I know that in covering stories like this, sometimes the folks that are at the table, they see eye to eye, but sometimes, you know, the decisions then go back to the Pentagon and they get rejected. So it's just curious, yeah, to see this process.
Yeah, and what ultimately comes out, you know, that's still to be seen. The Navy obviously wants to retain the use of the lands near the missile base, which they already own. How they go about doing that may be different. Their first proposal is that they just enter new real estate agreements. The second proposal that came up is that they, you know, possibly buy some of the lands that are more important to them, that have the storage facilities, the radars, the tracking equipment on the ridges that allow them to sort of keep track of targets in the air, as well as help the targeting systems at the missile range. The Navy has also said that they want to be able to help the state to, you know, properly assess any cultural impacts that this project might have. So they're going to be providing the state with enough information to evaluate the existence of archaeological and cultural sites, to evaluate the impact on those sites, and to help the state figure out how, you know, they can mitigate any potential impact that they could have on historical or cultural or archaeological sites in the area that the Navy is looking at.
Yeah, and the community just wants to make sure that, yeah, if there's any environmental issues and cleanup that needs to be done, that's done, and that there's, you know, money exchange, it's fair market, and not just a dollar a year.
Yeah, and DLNR has commented on the draft. You know, they want to make sure that, like you said, if there's hazardous waste, the Navy has a plan to clean that up. They want to ensure the protection of any Ifikupuna or burial remains on those lands. You know, sort of looming large over this is, you know, what happened a few years ago with the Red Hill fuel leak. So, you know, this is an agency that's still trying to rebuild trust in the community.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Blaise.
Thanks again.
We've been hearing from Blaise Lovell of Honolulu Civil Beat. You can read his story online at civilbeat.org.
As sea levels rise due to climate change, more and more coastal communities will cope with flooding. In the Netherlands, one dairy farm has come up with a solution: floating.
We go up and down with the tide, so we always can keep on producing fresh, healthy food.
That story and other global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Get ready to make fun of the headlines live. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is coming to Honolulu in October. To show our appreciation, HPR members get first access to tickets starting August 6th. Make sure you're ready. For more information, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/waitwait. Sponsored by Honolulu Financial Partners.
Has been grappling with a housing crisis for years. And so with all this talk about building affordable housing, we take a closer look at the formula for doling out tax credits and low-interest loans. HPR's Ashley Mizuo is here with news about a meeting tomorrow where changes to that formula will be taken up. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so, you know, one of the state's biggest investments over the last decade has been to subsidize affordable housing. Here's Senate Housing Committee Chair Stanley Chang.
If your listeners are out there wondering what the legislature is doing with your tax dollars, a lot of the budget is kind of already locked into place and we don't have that much discretion. But the single largest discretionary expenditure that we as legislators are making is funding the Rental Housing Revolving Fund, which funds subsidized housing in Hawaii.
So over the last decade, the state has invested over $1 billion into this rental housing revolving fund. And in the next 2 years alone, the legislature is putting in another $200 million into that fund. And so this basically gives favorable loans to affordable housing projects. You know, interest rates are typically below 1% and repayment periods sometimes don't start for 30 years because developers don't actually have to start paying back the state until it's already paid off private loans that are used to cover the rest of the project. So to compare that to the typical home buyer with, like, right now a 6% interest and a 30-year mortgage, it's extremely favorable. And that's often used in conjunction with federal low-income housing tax credits. And those can cover up to about 70% of the costs of projects over the course of 10 years for those who are considered very low income, which is like 60% or below of the annual median income.
And the whole idea is to really get these developers to
put up these projects so we can get more of these affordable units to the people.
Because affordable housing isn't going to get built without some type of subsidy, right? But all of that money from the Rental Housing Revolving Fund and the federal low-income housing tax credits gets dispersed through, you know, the housing agency, the state housing agency's point system called the Qualified Action Plan. And I'm going to refer to it as the QAP, and you're going to hear people refer to this as the QAP. And basically all it does is it gives points to projects based on criteria like project readiness, affordability periods, and development costs. And as you said, tomorrow, the Hawaii Housing Finance and Development Corporation is going to have a public hearing on how those points are allocated because it's considering some changes. Housing Hawaii's future executive director, Lee Wang, says these meetings are important because it can really determine what types of projects get built and by whom.
The QAP is essentially a gamification point allocation system to be able to have government, public, and other key stakeholders have a kind of input on what type of housing should be prioritized, where it should be prioritized, for whom, and how long it should stay affordable. And so the conversations coming up as it pertains to social benefit are important conversations that HHFDC is facilitating.
And so, you know, when you're giving public testimony, you're able to, the public's actually able to weigh in on this point system. It's actually a really interesting way that you can be involved in the planning of where this massive amount of investment from the state and federal government is going to disperse these funds into what types of projects that are going to be around as affordable for decades. Catholic Charities housing arm is a nonprofit that has successfully navigated this point process. It broke ground this year on Hale Pilina, a 178-unit affordable housing project on Maui. Their executive director, Denise Isseri Matsubara, says the QAP process is extremely competitive.
The scoring are sometimes, you know, only 1 or 2 points away from each other. It is a very competitive process, and rightfully so, because the state is allocating a huge amount of resource to go towards supporting, you know, low-income housing. You know, 1 point could make the difference.
So this idea and then this point system, and you want to make it fair.
Right.
So that we can get these units built faster.
Exactly. You want to make it fair. And, you know, the way that they allocate and weight the points really is going to determine the types of developments that come up and how quickly they're able to come up and how long they're going to remain as affordable. So one of the changes that the Housing Corporation is considering is decreasing the points for nonprofits down to just 1 point. Before it was 2 points. Previously, it's been 3. Isseri Matsubara says one of the benefits to having a community nonprofit as a developer is its mission is aligned with the state to preserve the housing as affordable. But nonprofits are already coming in at a disadvantage when they're competing with private developers because project readiness is weighted so heavily at 24 points, which requires a lot of upfront capital.
We're talking anywhere from $1.5 to $3 million upfront. And if you don't get an award, it could be very disastrous. And smaller nonprofits just don't have that kind of money. And Hawaii as a whole doesn't have a whole lot of small nonprofits developing housing.
Good point.
Yeah, and the affordability period of these projects has been a kind of contentious issue. You know, Senator Chang believes that developers that are getting these funds should have to keep a project affordable in perpetuity. You know, currently the least amount of time they can do it is 45 years, although if it expands longer, it can get more points.
Virtually every single one of them that was ever built is going to expire at some point between now and the year 2100. Every affordable housing building that we build is a ticking time bomb. The time will come when the developer is free to raise rents to market, kick out all the existing low-income tenants, and then bring in market rate tenants, and then sell the building for a fair market value and pocket all of the proceeds themselves.
And so, you know, while the state's housing fund has been around for just over a decade or so, the federal low-income housing tax credit has been around since the 80s. So some properties are actually already hitting their affordability periods or will eventually hit their affordability periods in the not super distant future. You know, the HHFDC says about 2,000 units that will hit that affordability period in the next 20 years, and some already have. Although buildings can also apply through the QAP for more funding to do renovations and then extend its affordability period, which is one way they try to incentivize buildings to keep elongating this affordability period, mm-hmm. even though it might be reaching that expiration date. But the QAP really prioritizes new buildings over renovations, giving it more points. An added layer to this is that the President Donald Trump's mega bill, H.R. 1, is going to actually greatly expand low-income housing tax credits nationwide, meaning that the QAP will actually likely be used to disperse even more funding in the future to affordable housing projects in Hawaii. And basically what they're doing, the way that the QAP works currently, is really focused on building more units quicker, which is why project readiness is weighted so heavily. And even if it puts government and nonprofit projects, which are likely more likely to preserve affordability because obviously they're not trying to turn a profit mm-hmm. on these buildings, it puts them at a disadvantage. But it's also a potential trade-off when it's the same for-profit developers that keep getting these really, really great funding situations for their buildings, and they may eventually end up just going back to market rate. Or in some places, the displaced tenants will organize and get the state or county to actually buy the building itself to preserve the affordability, which, you know, Senator Chang says is basically like the state or the county were paying for this building two right. times.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And then you've got an older building and maintenance to deal with.
Exactly. And so the state is having this public hearing on the QAP changes tomorrow. People can sign up until the end of the day to provide comments at the Hawaii Housing Finance Development Corporation website.
Yeah. So opportunity for the public to give their two cents. But again, trying to come up with a formula that's more fair across the board, and the bottom line, get those units built
right.
quicker.
How can we build units, keep them affordable, and for the long haul, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And the analogy about a ticking time bomb, yeah, that's the concern.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HBR's Ashley Mizuo. You can find the details for tomorrow's meeting on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. From the Hokulea to Chief of War, Magnificent Canoes, or Va'a, have been on the screen and front of mind. A critical part of construction were the lashings, you know, the rope, the cordage, which ancient Polynesians used to tie together their canoes. The skill of weaving cordage is an art, but it's also an essential part of constructing fishing lures, nets, and bindings for ki'i. Today, we're revisiting our conversation with Big Island carver and photographer Bojack Imuaki. Ki spoke with the conversation back in 2023 to share his mastery of cordage, an art passed down from his native Hawaiian father. HBR's Russell Subiono talked with Ki about his philosophy as an artist and a craftsman.
For me, it's very important to share our kaula, you know, our cordage, because without the cordage, we wouldn't be out throughout the Pacific. We wouldn't have voyaged anywhere.
We've known each other for a long time, but I did not know that you were an artist until I saw your photography of Mauna Loa. Can you talk about your early days of being an artist? How did you become known for your lashing?
So early on, I was a fisherman with my dad, and that's the first place where I connected with our ancestors, and I knew something was in me. So I made fishing lures early on, big game fishing lures. And then, I don't know, I just felt this strong connection, so I started researching about our makau, our ancient Hawaiian fishing hooks, and I wanted to wear one. And I just started carving them, but I really didn't know how to do any lashings. So I'm basically self-taught, you know, and a few trips back and forth to the museum. Peter Buck, the Bishop Museum Arts and Crafts book, that has been my Bible from day one. And just doing trial and error and just learning, you know, and kind of finding out that it was in my DNA. I just love it. I can't stop. You know, it's my muscle memory. And it just evolved from fish hooks. And then it evolved into adornments, more so adornments. I didn't want to be known as a fish hook guy. And so I switched over to adornments, which I still love making fish hooks, but I like to, the adornments that are kupuna made, and then kind of recreate them and then put my spin on them and kind of envision if I was back then or they were here now in present day, what would we do more or less? So it's just an extension of our kupuna's work that I feel I'm doing, and hopefully I'm doing them justice and they're proud, you know.
So once you started doing these lashings, at mm-hmm. what point did they get like a show or a display? How did the art center identify you as somebody who is proficient at this or a master lasher?
In Waimea, there was this art school called Hoea that Hiko Hanapi started, and that I ended up doing some lashings there. And just by sheer luck that I pulled in one day and I needed to show them my work, and they were actually losing money from my Anna grant and they needed somebody to teach. And then here I came in and showed them my work and they said, hey, would you teach classes? You know, I'm like, ah. And so I decided to jump in, and then one thing led to another. And I just been doing it ever since. That was what, in 2011, I believe, that I really started really trying to learn more and experiment. And just from that, and just erupted, and finding my culture and being proud of our culture, that has been huge for me. And then I got invited to a couple of indigenous gatherings down in Aotearoa, one that they asked me to teach cordage there. And here at this gathering, it was absolute masters, indigenous artists from all over the world, and they asked me to teach a class. And I'm like, holy cow, I can't imagine. So I did. You know, reluctantly, I did. And then one of the Maori wahinis there, Paula Rigby, she was one of my students there. And she saw how I taught the class and worked through everything. And so she's a master weaver down in Aotearoa. So she brought me in. So it's just really, it's about connections. And when I speak, I really feel like our cordage and our lashing is like our umbilical cord that connects us all, you know?
What incredible validation for the years of hard work that you put into honing your skill. Just going back to your roots, you were talking about learning how to make fish hook, and you learned how to tie hooks as well from your dad. What kind of family lineage do you have when it comes to this kind of artistry?
I was always around it. My dad made ukulele with my brothers, but really what my mom and dad were known for was making their vili vili leis and ni'ihau shell leis. They would actually be selling at the Mary Monarch, you know, if my dad was alive. So I was always around art and always around fine detail. My dad was always kind of hard on us. And if we want to go to the beach, he would pass us a bottle of ni'ihau shells and say, okay, before you guys go, you have to take out the sand from the pico, you know, so we'd sit there and take out all the sand. And before you know it, we couldn't go. It was too late. And he kind of knew that. But I think that attention to detail was passed down from my dad. And then it's a funny thing, because when I went to Hoea, we signed a waiver saying that we would allow the faculty to research our genealogy. And they found that I come from a long line of net makers on Molokai, and that they were very, very particular. And if the upena didn't open perfectly, they would burn it. They were perfectionists. So what they did at the school was kind of show all of us that we don't fall far from the tree. And all of us had real huge similarities to the description of our kupuna that was before us. Like I said before, it's in our DNA. We can't deny that.
Thank you so much for talking story with me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Malama pono.
That was Big Island artist Bo Jack Imuaki talking with HPR's Russell Subiano. The interview originally aired back in April of 2023. Key is currently documenting each volcanic episode of Kilauea. You can view some of his artwork and photography at his Instagram account. His handle is at Bo Jack Key.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has appointed new members to the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Panel. Some of those members believe in vaccine conspiracy theories. A former CDC advisor says,
"We are living in a dangerous moment right now, and I think we're right on the precipice of something much worse."
That's on the next On Point.
beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Today on The Daily, by almost all accounts, the historic trade deal that was just reached between the United States and the 27 nations of the European Union is far better for the U.S. than it is for Europe. I'm Mike Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Transformational. Think cell phones and access to a service for all. You might not know the name John Scarpa, but he co-founded the Cellular Network Corporation and Unitel, which is credited with bringing cellular service to rural areas in the U.S. His foundation just donated $700,000 to Hawaii Pacific University to launch an entrepreneurial pathway for students and faculty members. The new business dean of HPU joined us in the studio last week to talk about this new direction of the John Scarpa Initiative. Amy Nguyen Chung comes to Honolulu by the way of the Wharton School of Business and UC San Diego.
We are so excited to have this opportunity. It's going to open up a chance for all the students at HPU to get innovative coursework, innovative programming that will help spur entrepreneurial thinking skills that are in the area of being more resourceful, as we talked about. Yeah, really experimentation, iteration. Entrepreneurial skills are not just for startups. So we're going to be launching a program that will bring innovation to the campus. And also through a series of different programs, we have exciting the students about innovation and entrepreneurial thinking, and then engaging them with people who have been pioneers in this area.
Yes. And so essentially you're helping to match them up with mentors then to be able to spur that creativity.
Right, right. In one sense, we're going to start off with competitions and challenges for people to think, what can I do with entrepreneurial thinking? And it's really about problem solving, creative problem solving, and giving them the kind of the tools to do so. And we'll start that with first-year students, but we'll try to touch every class. And we're going to incentivize the faculty across the campus to be involved. And this funding is seed funding that allows us to give grants to the faculty across different disciplines. Many people can get involved in this process and bring new and exciting things to the students.
So it's a way then to maybe monetize ideas or somehow transfer the technology maybe into some commercial venture in the real world?
Yes. When you think of innovation, it can definitely be commercializing research of universities and so forth. But it can also be just bringing the ideas you have to market, or it can be applying problem solving to community problems. You have like community entrepreneurs, basically social and environmental problems as well. So entrepreneurial thinking is just really appropriate for everybody, not just the startup founders.
So it could be something where someone out in the field sees what's going on out in the trenches, and then maybe seeing where policies could be fine-tuned to help the people out there?
Definitely there could be a policy entrepreneur looking around the campus. I'm pretty new to HPU, just starting this month, but I've been working with the leadership on developing this program and looking to see what assets the university already has. And I see that this summer the university launched a marine circularity academy where we looked at the plastics problem and then gave students taking this four-session course the tools to try to develop problems answers for these problems, how to solve the plastics problems. So basically, if we can introduce students to tough problems out there, it really, the need spurs the creativity.
Yeah, what is it? It's the mother of invention?
right, necessity, yes.
And I guess throughout your career, what do you think works best to get these young minds maybe thinking in a different way or just giving them the freedom or the permission to try things and fail?
That's really important, what you just said. Not just trying to succeed, but learning from failure. And so I've worked with a lot of startups over time. My last work was leading a capstone of starting new ventures at San Diego. And we had MBAs and engineers in the classroom. And some of them would start with the idea that, oh, I've developed this in my lab. Whereas others would start, hey, I really need some. I know people really need this, right? So it's, there's a tug. There's some real needs and problems out there. And then sometimes there's something that you've invented. But ideally, we'd want our students to solve those big problems where there's a need.
I remember being a kid and going on a long hike to a waterfall, and we had to lug in this big, heavy cooler. And I just said, someone needs to invent a cooler that you could just, that's lightweight and you could just put on your back and carry it. And then, of course, decades later, someone comes up with that kind of a thing. And I thought, that when I was 10 years old. Right. But you go through the experience and you think, there's got to be a better way.
I often start with a few just images for the students and ask them, is this something that's needed? And sometimes it'll start a debate. I'd show them an image of Google Glasses type product for the blind. And we'd start talking about this and how do you evaluate that opportunity? And so it's a good exercise. And other times, students, sometimes it takes a little exercise to get them thinking out of the box. I saw one of my colleagues showing an image and a truck got stuck under a bridge. And the engineers come and they say, how do we raise that bridge to get the truck out? And then the truck driver comes over. What if we just let the air out of the tires? Yeah. So really trying to bring people from different disciplines together, you can solve problems better. Yeah, that's the idea of this initiative. It's going to be interdisciplinary, and it's going to start right off with the students as they come in, trying to open their eyes and excite them about new ways of thinking about problems.
Yeah, because there's more than one pathway to success, and
right.
However you can harness that,
yeah.
That ability to get where you need to go. And then, I don't know, do you think that we need to do a better job of cultivating that curiosity and creativity in lower education, in the children? Because by the time you get to college, I know some folks are more locked in and they're afraid to take risks.
I think that college is a good time to start because I think that, just for example, insurance rates aren't that cheap yet because I know that your risk-taking sensors and all that aren't fully developed yet. It's not too late in college. In high school, I think there's emerging a lot of entrepreneurial programs, and I think they're great. I think starting early is great. I remember I smiled when my daughter in elementary school decided I could make some money by selling tickets to my parents for my show. So she puts on a show and decides to sell some tickets. And
there
so, oh, very entrepreneurial. So it can start early from the lemonade stands and so forth. And I think our duty is not to dampen that. Just keep encouraging that. And it might start small. But I've had the chance to engage with some of the startups and startup community on the island, and I think there's great potential here. I think that definitely if we do get to startups, having these tools prepare the students well. But even if they have no interest in founding a startup, these tools can help them adapt to the changing, very rapidly changing world that we live in right now. And so those skills of problem solving, adaptability, resourcefulness, risk taking, experimentation.
Yeah, all good things, well. To explore, because who knows what it may lead to. Anything else you want to underscore just about this program and this opportunity that HPU has?
Yes, so there's several components in it. The biggest component is the faculty grants, which will help support faculty time and resources needed to create entrepreneurial classes and programming, like the one I mentioned before, solving the plastics problem. And so really that can touch every discipline in the school, from the nursing college that we have to liberal arts and the College of Business and the engineering areas and natural sciences and computational. So really every area. And the other part are the challenges, which really energize students to thinking about as they compete, trying to solve problems. We want to engage with the community. Some of the problems out there, social, environmental, many great community organizations are already working on them. So to learn more about those will connect the students with the community and engage them and try to have further thinking about, is there a better way to do some things?
So it's exposing the students to what's already out there, and hopefully they can take it to another level.
Okay. Right.
I don't know what might make this program different from what they might offer anywhere else.
Yes. So some elements are similar in that we can't do it all ourselves. We'll reach out to the entrepreneurial ecosystem and have entrepreneurs in residence. We'll involve alumni. So we have some really successful entrepreneurs and creative thinkers among the alum population of HPU. And those are some elements that will be similar. I think what's unique about this, and I'm coming from a very innovative, the prior institutions where I've been have some amazing entrepreneurial programs. But what's really unique about this is I feel like there is this effort to go across the entire university. So at UCSD, I was co-director of the Institute for Global Entrepreneur, which was a collaboration between the business school and the engineering school. And that itself was a really big collaboration. And then we sometimes involved folks over at the med school and so forth. But I've also been at University of Michigan and Berkeley and Penn Wharton School, and they have amazing entrepreneurial programs. But I was just thinking, wow, if the whole university were involved, then you could even do more. I think it's really promising that there's a mandate from the top here that we want to do.
Yeah, to integrate it all. Yeah, it can be, right. Become a lot more powerful.
And then if we engage the community, I think that would be even greater.
That was Amy Nguyen Chung, Business School Dean at Hawaii Pacific University. She was talking about a new $700,000 initiative to jumpstart entrepreneurship and innovation. Full disclosure, HPU is an HPR underwriter. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from the state's new fire marshal. Have questions about the response to the recent fires in West Oahu? Share your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.